Welcome to a podcast of Beyond the Book, a presentation of the not-for-profit Copyright Clearance Center. Copyright Clearance Center is the world's largest provider of copyright compliance solutions through a wide range of innovative licensing services and comprehensive educational programs for authors, publishers, and their audiences in academia, business, and research institutions. For more information about Beyond the Book and Copyright Clearance Center, please go to www.beyondthebook.com. The program you are about to hear was originally presented at the University of Texas in Austin. Beyond the Book's Christopher Keneally hosts Writing That Sings. Authors Jan Reed, Elijah Wald, Robert Cochran, and Jerma Jackson explore the challenge of translating music into words.
Good evening. My name is Chris Keneally, and I'm the Director of Author and Creator Relations for Copyright Clearance Center, and I want to welcome you to Beyond the Book. We're here in Austin at the Texas Memorial Museum, and it's a terrific opportunity to be here to discuss a subject that seems a really appropriate one for Austin, and that is music, actually writing about music. This is now the seventh in a continuing series of these programs, which we've taken on the road, if you will, just like musicians, itinerant musicians, from Boston to San Francisco and now here in Austin. And it's allowed us an opportunity to welcome distinguished authors and have in our audience writers of all groups and ages, and as well people from publishing and just readers too. Today we're going to look at a subject that truly is beyond the book, and that is, of course, music, which is by definition nonverbal. And as I thought about how a writer tackles writing about music, I realized that they're required to write about everything but the music itself. They can write about the composer, the artist that plays the music. They can write about the place where the music was made, the performance space itself. They can talk about the style of the music. And I wondered how style of music influences the style of writing. They can write about the famous artists, the ones who established the great names, and they can write about the ones that may have been forgotten by history. And they can also talk about subjects that are unique enough to the American experience, the role of religion in our culture, race, sex and gender. And finally, within academia, we can look at the question of what is the tradition itself? What exactly constitutes folklore, and how relevant is that to studies in our day? So again, welcome to Beyond the Book. And first I want to welcome to our panel the only musician on the panel, which I think is a rather interesting thing, and we'll talk about in just a moment, Elijah Wald. Elijah is an author and musician currently based in Los Angeles. His books include Escaping the Delta, a reexamination of blues history centered on the legendary Robert Johnson, Naco Corrido, a visit with the Mexican balladeers of drug trafficking, immigration, and politics, and the award-winning biography Josh White, Society Blues. His newest book, which really just came out just this month, is The Mayor of McDougal Street, Dave Von Ronk's memoir of the New York folk revival. He was the Boston Globe's world and roots music critic for many years, and in 2002 won a Grammy for his notes to the Ahuli Records 40th anniversary box. And Elijah, welcome to the program. I want to ask you about the Robert Johnson book in particular. And as you worked on that, you were drawing not only on your research, but inevitably on your acquaintance with the music that goes back quite a long way. Can you talk about that?
There are ways in which it certainly is clearly an advantage, but only if you're a musician of the same kind as the person you're writing about. I mean, I could play Robert Johnson's guitar arrangements, and because of that, there were things I could notice about them and say about them and, you know, sort of show links between him and other artists. But equally, that can lead you astray.
You began playing guitar when you were 9 years old, I think you said, and really started taking it quite seriously by the time you were 13. Who were some of your musical heroes at that point?
I started out with Woody Guthrie and Pete Seeger and Josh White. I had basically your standard communist 78 collection circa about 1942, because that's what my grandparents had on 78, and they wouldn't let me play the LPs, but the 78s were mine. So I grew up, I mean, literally, it was Paul Robeson, Josh White, Pete Seeger, Woody Guthrie, and the Red Army Chorus.
Has that informed the writing throughout, whether you're talking about those characters or any others? I mean, did that, for example, bring you to write about the Naco Corrido?
The corridos are the Mexican ballads that have largely emerged on the Texas border and that started telling historical stories, but now they're almost all of them about the drug traffic, I'd say about 98%, but still also deal with politics and immigration and everything else. And that book really came out of the fact that the songwriters who write these are by far the best known writers on social issues in Mexico, and yet most of them no one had ever bothered to interview.
So it was the writing there, it was not the music itself that...
Exactly. No, that book I was really writing about the epic poetry. And frankly, one of the things that attracted me to that was exactly the problem that you outlined. That, you know, if you write a book about salsa, you cannot give the reader a sense of what's great about it. But frankly, corridos are pretty boring musically. What's important is the lyrics, and you can put those on the page, and I can even translate them so that for an English speaker, the book is in fact more interesting than the music.
Well, you had done a lot of work writing about non-popular, if I can put it that way, music for the Boston Globe. Tell us about how you came to write, and perhaps it's important to add for people that your writing is not college-trained writing at all. In fact, you never even went to college.
I went for 1 year, yeah. No, it's true. Actually, newspaper training, I think, was very good for me because what I was doing was writing about music from all over the world for an American audience that, by and large, I could assume had never heard the music and maybe had never heard of the country it was from.
I'm listening to the music. What kind of research did you do? Because that would be in the late 80s, I think, and that was before the World Wide Web, so you couldn't Google someone.
If you're dealing with, say, Barbadian gospel music, that's a whole world. Or in fact, American black gospel music. It's a whole world which essentially doesn't exist on the internet.
Well, I was thinking, you know, again, you know, beyond our own country, so Salif Keita comes to mind. How would you find out about Salif Keita and his background in Mali if you didn't have access to those sources?
Salif Keita had a huge international publicity machine behind him to make my life easy. Some of it... You know, frankly, the answer to a lot of it is I didn't know a damn thing. And the advantage of my job was my readership didn't know a damn thing. So I didn't do reviews, I did interviews, and I basically would call up, say, Salif Keita and say, so where do you come from? What's it like? What do you do? Which were really the questions my readership had.
We'll talk later with Jan Reed, who interviewed very local musicians at the very beginning of the Austin music scene, and he became frustrated with talking with musicians because they often didn't either want to talk to him or didn't really have a lot to say about their music. What kind of techniques, interviewing-wise, would you engage in to get people to tell you about their music?
You have to understand, the people I was interviewing are people, in some cases, with mansions and swimming pools they've bought with their songwriting, and the fact that no one had ever bothered to come by and ask them what they thought about the world, you know, they basically felt I was overdue.
Dave Von Ronk, the subject or the author of your new book, The Mayor of McDougal Street, which is just out, encouraged you as a musician and as a writer, and I thought that was...
Yeah.
An especially interesting story. Tell us about
it. Yeah, very much so. He was an interesting guy. He dropped out of school when he was 14, but was the best educated man I've ever known, just in terms of general education. Him and Lewis Mumford, who also didn't go to college. You know, it's people... I think there are a lot of people who never got scared off reading, and so they just became absolutely voracious. And he was one of those. And it was funny because, I mean, he was known as this huge bear of a man and this growling, shouting blues singer. And off stage was, as I say, the best read man I've ever known. And when I first went to him, it was for guitar lessons, and I learned a lot about music from him. My whole book, Escaping the Delta, the Robert Johnson book, was based essentially on conversations with Dave. But... He also, when I started writing, started handing me, you know, You haven't read A.J. Liebling in particular, Calvin Trillin, H.L. Mencken, Joseph Mitchell, the people he felt were sort of, you know, the people you need to read if you're going to write nonfiction in America.
And that covers a wide ground, but in particular, you developed an outlook on your work that said you can write about something that someone doesn't even care about yet, and perhaps once they've put down the book, they're not going to care about it anymore. But while they're reading, the Nako Kurito, for example, people wouldn't be acquainted with the music. They may be not inclined to go and find it, but you hope that you engage them in the story while they read.
Well, I mean, I think any writer, if you're thinking about it as writing rather than just as putting research on the page, which, don't get me wrong, there's very much a place for, but if you are engaged in the writing as a craft, the dream is to write sentences that will carry people along whether or not they care about the research.
Looking back, which kind of writing is the most attractive to you now?
It's all part of a process. I mean, I personally, I love doing the research, and that holds true for all of the books. And honestly, I don't think you can do historical work if you don't love doing the research. I think most of us I'm sure there are exceptions, but I think most people who write history feel like the research is the fun part, and then you have to write the damn book.
And again, you're the only musician on the panel. You're also the only one with a Grammy. But what's curious about that is you didn't win the Grammy for your music.
Yes, right.
You won it for your writing. And what has winning a Grammy meant to you?
The morning that the nominations were announced, Bob Blumenthal, who had been the Boston Globe's jazz critic, and who had won the Grammy for Best Liner Notes the previous 2 years running, called me up and said, you know, I just think I ought to tell you, after I won the Grammy first time, I had the worst year I've ever had financially as a writer. And after I won it the second time, I had an even worse year than that one. So I wouldn't say that things actually got worse financially for winning the Grammy. But no, nobody cares.
But you said someone suggested, was it Bob, that you ought to leave the Grammy in the bathroom?
No, that was actually that was the best idea I had for what to do with the damn thing was a friend of mine who said you should put it in the bathroom, and then everybody, when they use the bathroom, can pick it up and look at themselves in the mirror and give their acceptance speech. Wait.
Sounds like a great idea. Elijah, thank you very much indeed.
Thank you.
I'd like to turn now to Jerma Jackson. Welcome, Jerma. Jerma is an associate professor of history at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Her main research interest is 20th century social and cultural history, with a special emphasis on African American life, religion, music, and women's history. And her new book, Singing in My Soul, Black Gospel Music in a Secular Age, which came out last year from the University of North Carolina Press, traces gospel from its beginnings as a mode of worship to its emergence in commercialized culture during the 1940s and 50s. And welcome, Jerma, to be on the book.
Thanks for having me.
As an historian, why write about music?
Well, I decided to write about music because of my father, actually, because I think he really conveyed, growing up, the power of music. He would sing, he would teach us all these songs. We would go visit with family, friends. And you couldn't leave the house without everyone engaging in a song. Music carried us, had the potential to carry us to this other place that could not be replicated through conversation. And it seemed to me that the power of music made it an important or potentially important vehicle to understand experience.
What's interesting there was that your father would sing these songs. He didn't have to explain why or really what he was doing. He simply sang. But
right.
But you as a young person were thinking about the explanation behind it, finding meaning in it.
One of the things that really strikes me about musicians is that you don't ask them what they mean. You just either get it or you don't. And one of the things I think that's fascinating about African American history is that often people are translating it. And with musicians, they just play, right? It's our responsibility as listeners to make meaning out of it. And it seemed to me that that made music really important to study, particularly because as a historian, I wanted to look at meaning.
In the Singing in My Soul, you find that meaning in lots of different places. Let's talk about a few. First, in some individual stories of accomplishment. The central character, if you will, is Sister Rosetta Tharpe.
Yeah.
Introduce her for the audience, and then we can talk about why she's so important.
Sister Rosetta Tharpe is a gospel singer who began singing the music as a young child. She grew up in the Church of God in Christ, which was part of the Sanctified Church, a group of independent Black denominations and congregations that began to take shape in the 1890s. The members of the Sanctified Church disapproved of the growing emphasis on political and social matters. They felt like the society was getting away from religion, and they wanted to get back to religion. So they believed in a static religious worship. And she was very much part of that community. In 1938, she's a young adult, and she appears on the stage of the Cotton Club. Cotton Club is a New York nightclub that features Black musicians who often perform before white audiences. Most of the musicians who perform there are jazz musicians. So here was a gospel singer in a community that really made rigid distinctions between the church and the world.
And that then sparked controversy. It wasn't as if people congratulated her for having made that.
The Cotton Club is the major artery, one of the major arteries of the Black music industry. So although African-American audiences were not there, Black newspapers were there. Some of the shows were broadcast on the radio. So once she goes to the Cotton Club, what she really is doing is bringing gospel music into the commercial arena.
Your research unearthed all kinds of materials. Give us an idea of the sorts of things you looked at and had to examine to find meaning.
A number of really amazing sources came from the Black press. I read the Pittsburgh Courier from 1900 until like 1950, and ended up stumbling on a series of editorials about swinging spirituals, which really, really was a turning point in the book, because when she goes to the Cotton Club, she goes at the precise moment when jazz bands began integrating spirituals into their repertoires. The other very, 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 very important source was oral histories. There were so many people that I interviewed who really made a difference. A number of cases, I interviewed people and I would ask them if they had any programs, any material about the church in their, you know, homes, and they did. And they shared those with me, and that was made all the difference.
Well, that's what obviously is apparent when you talk about it. And I think that that's, again, back to the sort of common theme here, people trying to find some place within the musician's life or their, you know, what kind of came up around them, the articles,
yeah,
and so forth, that can give the insight. It's not the music itself. The music is sort of a part. It escapes the historian or it escapes the writer.
You know, there's a way in which gospel music and jazz and blues are celebrated today as, you know, popular forms of Black music. But one of the things I discovered is that these were also styles of music that were immensely controversial. It was important to me to tell the story of the popularity as well as the controversy, because to me they're part of the same coin.
Right. And for us today as an audience of the music, we listen to it for pleasure, and we sort of missed out on the background there, and it's something you brought back for us, and thank you for that. We'll continue talking in just a few minutes.
Sure.
Thank you Professor Jackson. Thank you indeed. Well, I want to welcome Bob Cochran to the panel. Bob is a professor of English and chair of American Studies, as well as the director of the Center for Arkansas and Regional Studies at the University of Arkansas. He is a three-time Fulbright lecturer and Guggenheim Fellow, and among his many published books are A Photographer of Note, Arkansas Artist Galeev Greece, Vance Randolph, An Ozark Life, and Singing in Zion. His most recent book, Our Own Sweet Sounds, A Celebration of Popular Music in Arkansas, was published in March 2005 by the University of Arkansas Press. And welcome, Bob, to Beyond the Book. I think it's an interesting segue to go from Jerma Jackson to yourself, because you share some things in common, both coming out of the university experience and trying to deal with giving meaning to musical experience within, largely speaking, a folk tradition. But the term folklore itself is one that is a bit problematic, and I wonder if you can start out by telling us how it sits on campus today and what you think of it yourself.
On my campus, it's real simple, and I think I share this with many people who teach folklore classes. The course is an elective. It satisfies no requirement. So you pretty much get your people in your folklore classes because they took another class with you and liked it. So it's, you pretty much have to sell folklore. And I do it. I do it in my other classes. I often sort of work some form of traditional culture, which is probably the term I would use rather than folklore. I work some traditional culture elements into my other classes and try to suggest, not heavy-handedly, that it's remarkably tenacious for a good reason, that it's surprisingly complex when you look at it, and it's best, like high culture, it's surpassingly lovely, too.
And it attracts quite a wide range of students, right? In fact, a student came to your class that led to the book you created most recently, Singing in Zion.
Yeah, that's actually my favorite book. Most of the books that I've done were sort of brought to me. I was asked to do them. And the advantage of that is, especially if the person asking you to do it is a publisher of a press, then you don't have to market the book. And most of the books I've written pretty much had a place they were going to be published before I wrote them. But Singing in Zion was my own. I generated that book out of a student encounter. And it led me to the longest project I've ever done. It took me a decade to write that book, and basically it was a social process. It was a process of getting to know a family well enough that they would sort of tell me what the music meant to them. Both Jerma and Elijah have talked about this. That music is a social thing, and I was more interested in the audience. I was more interested in what people did when they listened to music.
Well, tell us just a bit about how this all began. At the end of a class, one of the Gilbert sisters came up to you with a book of her own.
Yeah, many families, not just in the South, but maybe it's a little more common in the South, keep what they in the mountains call ballot books. And it doesn't have anything to do with voting. They're lyric sheets for ballots. And ballads is generously defined there. A ballad, as most of the people I've talked to define it, as just any song that they like. It doesn't have to be what a scholar would call a ballad. And she told me that her family had in their possession a book, loose leaf, that had some 240 songs in it that they had some sense regarded as their own. They had a proprietary interest in these songs, and it meant that they sang them and they liked them, and that their parents and relatives had sung them. So that was the start of that project. I was interested in why they preserved these songs, what the songs gave back to them. That's why it took so long, because I wanted to connect the songs and their allegiance to the songs with their family history.
Jerma talked about going back to materials, from decades past, but you were dealing with the living, and that's an interesting and exciting challenge, but I'm sure sometimes a daunting one.
Yeah, it is, and I can put that real succinctly. It has a great upside, because you know when you go into the project, you have a sense of when you're done. You're done when the people you're writing about are happy. You know, that's you have a sense of closure. The upside is that if nobody else likes this book, the people you wrote about are going to call you up and send you messages and invite you to their reunions, and they're going to be made happy. So at the very least, when you're shaving in the morning and you're thinking, maybe I'm wasting my life, you can always refer to those conversations, and you're sure you haven't. The downside is equally succinct. You serve as a pallbearer a lot.
As a scholar, as somebody on campus doing this kind of writing, as you admit, it's fairly innovative, and in a fashion, it's closer to journalism, but there's a distinction. Talk about that.
For me, scholarship is journalism with loose deadlines, and that's the way I've worked for my whole career.
Yeah, it wouldn't work to get an assignment and say, okay, I'll be delivering that story to you in 10 years.
In 10 years, yeah. It doesn't work. So I learned a lot, and I have nothing but respect for journalists.
Germer takes specific incidents and kind of draws some general conclusions. You have this very specific family, the Gilberts, and I don't think you try to go too much farther than the family itself with your conclusions. Is that on purpose?
I really have almost no ambition to generalize. I just want to get this thing as right as I can. And in that book, I actually found some theorist who agreed with me, and he said, the particular does not yield to the general without loss. And I quote that in the book. And, you know, I have respect for generalizations. I think they're generally useful. That's a wonderful phrase. But they can be useful. But my own personal predilection is just to try to get this thing as right as I can.
In Singing in Zion, the Gilbert family takes a journey, if you will, from the oral tradition to our own day, and that is a story of technology coming into the music. The radio, the first radio stations down in Arkansas have a whole variety of radio programs that, you know, live music and so forth. There's a moment when one of the sisters is given an opportunity to play, or a few of the sisters are given an opportunity to play. They end up not doing so. You make much of that particular moment. And when we talked earlier, you said that you felt that the fears people had at the time that radio was going to be a destructive force on the tradition haven't been played out. Can you talk about that, and can you extend that to our own day? Is what's happening with the internet and so forth amplifying tradition, or is it finally having the destructive effect people have feared before?
It's a no-brainer. They amplify it. There's no way around that. My daughter can amass in an hour a musical library that took me 20 years to amass. It's an absolute cornucopia out there.
But sometimes isn't less more? If you have all of that, it becomes hard to find your own voice and so forth. I think there's still the tension between the opportunity for the technology to get the music out and for people to learn from it. But at the same time, it kind of has the opportunity to wash away what's been trying to grow on its own by the side of the road.
Yeah, I guess I don't think it washes it away. I think it nourishes it. One of the things in the last 20 years or so of scholarship, you know, you establish these genres of popular music. You establish country and R&B and blues and all these things. And then those categories reify, and you classify someone as a country artist or a blues artist. But once you have radios, and German mentioned that this music grew up in a segregated society, and that's absolutely true. Once people get radios, and they got those little radios, you know, there's people in this room who grew up this way. You know, you're a kid, you go to sleep at night, you got your little radio right beside you, and you're picking up XERA, or you're picking up WLAC, you're picking up stations, and you can't segregate a radio dial. So that there's a much wider menu of music is on the air.
You and I toured the exhibit that gave rise to our own Sweet Sounds. And what's remarkable about Arkansas is that it's the home of Al Green and Conway Twitty.
And Rosetta Tharpe.
Yeah. I mean, for such a state to have that kind of richness. I had to ask you, what's in the water in Arkansas that gives it that tremendous musical tradition?
Let me close with just tying that question to what we just talked about. In 1995, I was a Fulbright lecturer in Korea. I was walking down the street, and I heard a song that I knew, but it was by a strange group. It was coming out on the street from a record store in the biggest city I've ever lived in my life, Seoul, Korea. And the song is Long Black Veil, and some of you may know it. Long Black Veil was a hit in 1959. It was written by some professional songwriters, but the first person to have a hit with Long Black Veil was a country singer named Lefty Frizzell. He grew up in Arkansas, so I knew this song, but I couldn't place it. I said, I know the song, but I couldn't place the singers. Some of you may place it from 1995. I went into the store. They don't speak any English. I don't speak any Korean, but I point out to the thing, you know, to the loudspeakers, and they bring up a CD. It's The Chieftains. And the lead vocalist, I learned by looking on the back, is Mick Jagger. So here we have an American country song recorded by an Arkansas singer. I'm hearing it in Korea by an Irish band with an English lead vocalist. That's technology.
Jan Reed, welcome to Beyond the Book. Jan grew up in the ranching and oil field county of North Texas, and he now lives in Austin. He's a writer-at-large for Texas Monthly and has written for Esquire, GQ, New York Times Magazine, Men's Journal, and Slate. His writing has been anthologized in The Best American Sports Writing, The Slate Diaries, The Best of Texas Monthly, and Texas Short Stories. He's won numerous awards, and his latest book is actually his first book. It was recently reissued by the University of Texas Press, and it's called The Improbable Rise of Redneck Rock, which came out in 1974. He's written 8 books since then, including a novel, a nonfiction of focus and range from Willie Nelson to George Foreman, Karl Rove to the Rio Grande. I want to welcome Jan Reed.
Thank you.
Jan, in writing, as with almost everything else, timing is everything, and especially in the case of Redneck Rock. How did that good timing sort of come to happen to you, if you will? I mean, tell us about the background there. It was the rise of the music scene. It was the rise of Texas Monthly, and it was the beginnings of a writing career for Jan Reed.
Well, like a lot of people that had grown up in the boondocks and the last picture show country, or in the pines, or in the chaparral, there was all this tug of getting to Austin one way or the other. And I, being fairly conventional, was, okay, I'll go down there to graduate school. Musicians were drawn to Austin, and have been for generations, because of it's the most bohemian city, and it's friendly to creativity, and so there was an active music club scene beginning when I arrived, but in the course of those 2 years, it just exploded and became this really short-lived mania, but it was a lot of fun. Folks started a magazine, and there were a number of talented folks who were immediately drawn to it. Most of us were 28, 29. We had no experience. We were just following our noses. And the magazine article led to a book, and it was quite a ride.
But it has to be pointed out that you were looking into the subject, which didn't yet have the notorious name. We'll get to that in a moment. As somebody who wasn't necessarily a fan of the music, in fact, you really weren't much of a fan of country music at all, isn't that right?
Well, I sort of started and stopped with Hank Williams, and I remember in the pool hall and the jukebox days, there was one really interesting voice that jumped out at us, and that jumped out at me, and it was Willie Nelson, and that was in his early Nashville days. Jazz phrasing, but this, just an amazing writer, and is one that connected with it. But what struck me was that there were people in my background, they were looking towards San Francisco But there they were up there with playing fiddles and pedal steels, and to my ear, they were making, it was country, but they were making these country instruments into rock and roll.
So, in fact, it was that music that bridged, and for you and for lots of other people, from that kind of stilted country music to something else. It really had a kick to it.
I could hear the gospel, I could hear the blues, the rock and roll, and it was fresh. It was obvious to my ear and my eye that this, what was going on here in the 70s, was different. It wasn't being repeated anywhere else in the country.
How much of a challenge was it to interview some of the characters that are involved here? I mean, we're talking about people who go from Willie Nelson to Kinky Friedman, and it's really apparent in the book that a great many of them were not easy to interview.
Some were difficult. Some were, happy to do it. They were all being kind of, it was sort of, most of them were young. It was new to the experience. They weren't jaded by it. But I have to say that all of them, they were all generous with their time and just giving some thought to what a very green reporter was throwing at them.
What did you have to do to get close to them, to really get something out of them? And there's been a common theme here about how hard it is for musicians to talk about their music. You went to their homes, you went to the performances. What kinds of things did you do to get close to them?
It was so accessible then. A lot of it was, you didn't, backstage passes were sort of, superfluous. You could walk up to the stage and grab them, and if they were interested, they'd say, yeah, come on back. But looking back on it, it's really pretty amazing how many of them just said, well, yeah, come on out. They were always late, and sometimes it was intentional just to jack the reporter around. But it was where they wanted, where they'd be comfortable, and so they didn't want to meet me somewhere. They said, just come out to my house, and that was always an adventure with Willie Nelson, because there was a lot of smoke in the air. As there still is in Austin, but the most powerful smoke I've ever encountered was always wafting through Willie Nelson's house. So it was a challenge to remember what the last question was.
Well, Jerma talked about the controversy around the music that she wrote about. You made a controversy, if you will, by giving the title to the book. Can you tell us about that and how you feel about that 30 years on?
It just came to me, Redneck Rock, and that was, as you were saying, I was writing about the audience as much as the music, and that was one of the most striking things about it, is that it was a time when, there's this tension and hostility between the hippies and the cowboys, and suddenly they were in the same room, and it was a lot of it was redneck rock and roll, but there were some of those musicians who were, they were hugely offended by, everything I stand for is against rednecks, but it was intended to be just a book title that would people would remember, but it did not have a great intellectual content. It was tongue in cheek.
And yet it's a book you've lived with and had to learn to live with for 30 years and 3 editions, and the most recent one just this past month coming out. And it was when you worked on that, really the first time you'd written about music in a long time, and you had a chance to see Austin's music scene today. What do you make of it today?
It's bigger, the tastes are certainly more diversified. You have musicians finding this niche and this style. But where Austin was then and where it still is, and I think it's built on itself as well, it's been a place where talented musicians could break into business, and they could get gigs, and they could, sleeping on the floor and broken down vans and all that. But they were in the business, and it was a bridge from getting from performance music to recorded music, It's built on its reputation of being this live music scene, and at the time that was one of the reasons it was dismissed in Nashville and Los Angeles, because it was just clubs and there weren't recording studios here.
And just to sort of bring us back to some of the things Bob was talking about, the technology has helped it make that leap from just a live music scene to a recording center, because it's just so much easier today to produce something that sounds good. In the book, you talk about the difficulties that Jerry Jeff Walker faced in trying to record in his home studio 30 years ago. Today,
let me give you an example of the Dixie Chicks had started as a bluegrass group in Dallas, and they changed singers, and daughter of a steel player in Lubbock came in as their new lead singer, because their singer had a baby. Anyway, they formed the group they had now, and they had two Nashville records that were very successful, and but they wanted to do a recording that went back to their taste and take on bluegrass, and their producers in Nashville didn't want anything to do with it. So they got their dad, the steel player, and the father to produce it, and went out to a little recording studio out in South Austin, and the technician has a little mixing board that was Elvis Presley's portable mixer, you know. But that record became their big smash, you know, breakthrough through record. But it was done in this little limestone cottage out on Manchuck Road in Austin.
Well, that's what's terrific about your book. I was listening to music like that at the time, and you managed to capture at a very important moment, put it in a bottle, what that scene was like. And now it becomes more apparent 30 years on how important that was, and how it was a turning point for country music as well as really for rock music. And thank you for that. Thank you, Jan.
Thank you.
Things I think has been really interesting in tracing the evolution of gospel is tracing a music that began as a mode of worship and becomes a commodity. And I think that to see that transformation is really interesting. And I think Thomas Andrew Dorsey is a pivotal transitional figure here, as someone who was a blues musician in the 20s, had a successful career as a blues musician, turns his attention, you know, to gospel music and commits himself to gospel music. But in the process of doing that, finds that he has difficulty, and he writes gospel songs, he has difficulty getting his gospel songs in mainstream black churches. So what he decides to do is to bypass the ministers who oppose his songs by moving into the commercial arena. His school, Dorsey's school, was the blues industry. That is how he learned. He knew every aspect of the music industry. And so what you see in Dorsey is a person who's willing to move to first commit himself to gospel music. He can't get his music through. He moves into the commercial arena and begins to publish individual songs as sheet music and sells them. This is a very important development, because up until that time, in the Baptist church, if you wrote any kind of religious music, it would be published in a denominational hymnal. So he's bypassing the denominations, moving into the commercial arena. But Dorsey never wants to become a corporate capitalist. He only publishes his own songs. I mean, a way to make money as a publisher is to hire out other writers and get them to work for you, a kind of hiring out system. Jersey only publishes his own stuff. And I think most people would think, oh, he just didn't understand the business. No, he understood the business all too well. Actually, what he wanted to do is to hold on to his religious beliefs and this commercial arena. And so when the music becomes immensely, immensely popular, Dorsey, who had really created the infrastructure for gospel, is outraged. Because, you know, the problem, and I want to get back to, I think, something you said, Bob, about technology, that was a soft question, an easy question. And I want to put on the table that technology has possibilities, as you suggested, but also new burdens. And I see that with gospel music, where here's a music that began as a religious experience and became a commodity, but that the community no longer exerts complete control over. And that, to me, yes, it's more accessible, but then who controls it? That's a real debate. And so in the gospel community, that gets, you know, it fosters and facilitates a debate about what is the meaning of faith. And what does it mean when you sing a song in a cotton glove versus in a church? I want to put that on the table because I think with technology creates possibilities, but it also creates some new burdens that people have to deal with.
And I love the word that Jeremy picked, burden. You know, my stress is on the sort of richer palate. I completely accept the notion that there are additional burdens. And it becomes, once you get these hybrids, the whole notion of cultural property or control, as you used it, becomes incredibly vexed. If you ever interest yourself in the story of Elvis Presley, for example, if you look at the sort of journalism from the 70s, you know, you often hear this stuff about Elvis Presley exploiting African-American music. He records Hound Dog after Big Mama Thornton does. And you get all this very angry rhetoric, but the game is already over by that time. You know, all you gotta do is push it one step further back. It's true that Big Mama Thornton recorded Hound Dog before Elvis Presley. All you gotta do is, when you hear anybody getting really overheated about where things go, ask them who wrote Hound Dog. and Jerry Lieber and Mike Stoller, you know, two East Coast, you know, professional, very successful professional songwriters. Whole groups were created in rock and roll to sing Lieber and Stoller material. So the weave gets so complex that probably the word burden understates it almost. Yeah.
I would say very often the people who are looking for authenticity are looking for something that they know nothing about, which is what they mean by authenticity. And, for example, in the case of Sister Rosetta Tharpe, I think the white New York audience of the Cotton Club were thought what they were seeing was that real old down-home darky religion like they have down in Arkansas, whereas the congregation in Arkansas felt like what they were seeing was somebody betraying her heritage and playing jazz. So it's sort of an interesting, I think the quest for authenticity by and large is a quest for a mythical other, and hence, to me, highly suspect.
Well, you know what we're going to do then? We're going to use that as a nice segue to turn this talking program into a music program. We're going to have Elijah Wald close us out with a song. We just bought that guitar on eBay. It is nobody's at all. And I want to thank you all for joining us. Thank the panel, Bob Cochran, Jan Reed, Jerma Jackson, Elijah Wald. Thank the Texas Memorial Museum. And on behalf of Copyright Clearance Center and our author and creator relations program, I'm Chris Keneally. Thank you for joining us. Elijah.
From 4 till 8, I was wringing my hands and crying. Say, from 4 till 8, I was wringing my hands and crying. gets a 36-hour ride. Say from Memphis to Norfolk, it's a 36-hour ride. Well, a man is like a prisoner, he's never satisfied. And a woman is like a dresser, some man's always fumbling through her drawers. Say a woman's like a dresser, some man is always fumbling through her drawers. Cause so many men try to act like Santa Claus.
Beyond the Book is an educational presentation of the not-for-profit Copyright Clearance Center. With conferences and seminars featuring leading authors and editors, publishing analysts, and information technology specialists, Beyond the Book is the premier resource for knowledge on the latest business issues facing today's dynamic publishing industry, from initial research to final publication and beyond.